This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Voice of San Diego podcasts are sponsored by the Bob Nelson Charitable Fund, honoring the San Diego Harbor Police Foundation.
Maybe desperate for any deal at any price. My focus has been on...
That was very loud. I'm amazed at how loud that barking was.
So somebody wanted to drop something off on our doorstep. Isn't that very nice?
It's disruptive.
All right. Can I just pick up at the Elliot quote? 3, 2. Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 COGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. I'm joined, as always, of course, by assistant editor Andrew Keats. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Scott. Happy to be here.
Are you happy? Mm-hmm. And managing editor Sarah Libby, who I know is happy to be here, has no other conflicts, nothing else distracting her today. She's here enjoying podcasting. Especially with Andy. She loves Andy and all of his asides. Everybody is just happy times in pandemic land. Coming up on the show today, you can get your hair cut. You can get it colored. No facials. We have the week and reopening update. All of it, of course, has just made me more worried about schools, though. In Encinitas, a parking lot has become a site of major drama this year. City residents were upset about it becoming a long-term parking option for people who are living in their cars. This week, law enforcement stood behind the lot as it got its extension and revealed who they thought was actually making the trouble there. We'll talk about that. And by the time you hear this, the city of San Diego and SDSU will likely have made a historic deal transferring the Mission Valley Stadium land to the university. What it all means, what happens now, maybe some bit about what was holding it up at the beginning. But first, let's talk about this. The great reopening 2020 proceeds along in a scattered, confusing way. Just got an email from the YMCA saying that summer camps are coming the end of June. A little different. They've been checking with the Camping Society and a few other groups to get their regulations down. What are we comfortable with doing these days, and where is the confusion still remaining? So I'm going to hold off on the haircut, I think, for a while. It's fine. Nobody's bothered by it, really. Like, what's the point? Going to let the people go get their haircuts that really want it for a while. I don't know. Andy, you only get your haircut like once a year anyway, so it's not a big deal.
Got to tell you, this has put into stark contrast the extent to which I maybe should care a little bit more about my appearance. Seeing how many people are like an issue for them in this quarantine is that it's been a long time since they've had a haircut. Just, it makes me feel very guilty.
Does it?
I have not paid enough attention to that part of my life, apparently, because this is all very normal for me.
It took me till about 38 to get better at personal grooming.
Like, yeah, I know. Maybe this will be the thing for me now. I'll just realize that that's part of being an adult.
Sarah, you do any colors or facials or anything? You're excited to get back?
I have not. I've never colored my hair ever, but it could really use a cut. But I'm not doing that anytime soon.
I think one of the biggest things that stood out, there were a lot of restaurants that were given the opportunity to open and several have not yet, and not necessarily because they're restricted from it. Obviously, they're dealing with lower occupancy restrictions, stuff like that. But I also think there's still what we're sort of laying bare is what we talked about last week, which is that there's the government restrictions that are one problem, but then there's just the virus that's the other problem, and people's rational and sometimes not rational fears about different things. And they're not going to automatically go out to these places. And so let me throw something by you. I've been thinking a lot about masks, right? And to me, there's the obvious thing with masks. Like if you sneeze, if you cough, if you speak loudly, it stops the droplets from coming out, protects other people. There's that, right? But there's also a thing with the masks, like that is a way of like telling everybody else you're doing your thing. You're part of the group. That masks are a way for us to actually start going back out to address that whole issue about the confidence and fear about going out. To actually like say like we're going out, we're going to be part of society, we're going to interact, and this is one way to communicate that we're following all the other rules too, so that we can like have more confidence with interactions, because the confidence is the problem if there's some things open and they're not being filled and stuff like that. And so that's I don't think we're getting enough of a manual about how to live right now, right? Like a manual for just what life should be like if we're going to not just be completely locked in our homes.
Yeah, one thing I've been thinking about a lot is our daycare is reopening, and I think we've probably decided to send our son back to daycare, which is a hard decision. But because of that, I think we're going to be probably participating in society even less, just because, you know, he's already going to be exposed to these other children, and we want to take as many precautions as we can that we're not, you know, exposing ourselves to all this extra stuff and then sending him off to be around other kids and their families and their teachers and things like that. And so it's hard to balance, like, because you're taking part in one thing, do you take part in anything else? And how much do you, like, cross contaminate all of those experiences?
Yeah, that's a good point, Sarah. Similarly, we are forced to confront the daycare question right now. And I think, as I've said in the past, it was easy enough when everything was closed. There were no decisions to be made. Now things are opening, and there's this discretion that I need to exercise. And I just don't feel like I actually have enough information at my disposal to do so responsibly and adequately. So I feel like I'm sort of just left to guess to some extent. I mean, I can read up as much as I can, but I'm not an epidemiologist. I don't know exactly how much more risk I'm introducing from one decision or another, which I don't love. And I think masks are somewhat the same way. I mean, we have the official guidance about when you're supposed to wear a mask, and every day that official guidance seems to get farther from what the norm that we're trying to impose. I mean, right down to the county's official slogan is not consistent with the county's official guidance. And so there's all these decision points that people are faced with. That where they're left with, I think, at least to me, contradictory information about what they're actually supposed to do. And so when you say a guide for how to live, like, conflicting information is the opposite of a straightforward guide for how to live.
Yeah, absolutely. What's the slogan versus the guidance?
When you leave your place, cover your face.
Okay, but yeah, the literal guidance
is... But the actual guidance is, if you're in public and you can't stay within 6 feet of somebody, cover your face.
Yeah.
And those are, so now if it's the former, sure. But it, you know, it's like, just because one is a little bit easier to fit into a jingle, doesn't necessarily mean that it is the one that is most scientifically relevant. But it does seem to be more the case that is the one that is being used to shame people.
And that's why I think it's a little frustrating that it's broken down in this like liberal versus conservative thing, because if the conservatives are so fired up about getting people out and getting people engaged in the society, then I think that they would want to be more on board with like this sort of thing. Like, what can we do to help people understand specifically a manual to life right now so that they can feel more comfortable about going out and spending money and stuff like that. And, you know, masks play a role in that. And in official circles, like the county's official, like, you know, policies now, they're on board, you know, making these decisions. But it's just such a dissonance out there. Like, I think another one that came out this week that caught my eye was the churches. You can open a church now at 25% capacity. But they're also like, you shouldn't do it. You know, like, yeah. It's like, right. Okay, well, that's a really interesting perspective for if you're running a church right now to have to deal with. You know, like, that's a tough burden you've placed on those folks.
Yeah, it reminds me of when my wife was pregnant with our first child, and it's just a list of things you can't do.
Yeah,
and right, it's all exactly. Binary. It's all binary. Nobody provides you a list of like, well, you know, you should understand the risks associated with these sorts of things, and here's the trade-offs that you're going to be balancing in those sorts of decisions. It just doesn't work like that. It's all risk elimination. If there's a potential downside to something, you just don't do it. And again, in this present situation, maybe that is right. But as we start to open things up and that binary breaks down, it just leaves me with a lot of stress in making decisions that I don't feel very qualified to make.
Yeah. So obviously a lot of this is now feeding into the schools. I spoke this week with David Miyashiro. He runs this, he's the superintendent of Cajon Valley Elementary School District. And he was talking about how hundreds of students that they were in touch with before the pandemic have moved or otherwise disappeared. They have a significant group of people ready to go back to school, but there's 25% of parents who are like, nope, not going back until there's some sort of, you know, definitive vaccine or something like that. And so I just think we're heading again towards a couple of really scary moments with this school thing. Like, are they going to be able to open back up? What's the enrollment crisis if they do decide on distance learning, or even if they do decide to go back? You know, districts right now get their money from the state based on the students who go to school. If a bunch of students choose other options, their already existing financial problems are going to get compounded. There's the whole issue of the economy. How can we have a functioning economy if there's no functioning schools and for what people do? I mean, we have our own employees and other people who are like, I don't know how I'm going to keep functioning even at this level of productivity without places for people to send their kids. So I don't know, still in the middle of this confusion. Hopefully we can get a little bit farther, I think, on that sort of manual about life. Because, you know, as I spoke with that epidemiologist last week, there is a lot of parallel that we can get from HIV. You know, the know your status, get tested a lot, know the status of your network, get tested a lot. Also know how to protect yourself, because just not going out or not being, you know, telling people not to engage with other people was not a solution to HIV. And I don't think it's a solution to this. But, you know, it's weird. Like, things come up. Like, we have a 13-year-old living in our house now. My cousin has moved in to go to high school here. And she, you know, she met a friend. And I was stoked about that. And the friend's street over. And they're walking around OB. We let them walk around OB, go surfing, stuff like that. But, you know, like, what's okay? I don't even know what's okay for a 14-year-old to do normally, let alone like what's okay, you know, in a pandemic, like stay outside. It does seem like we're boiling it down to that one restriction, which is don't gather inside, especially where people are speaking loudly or singing or something. Don't do that. But that's what school is, so I don't know.
It's also what church is.
Okay, as you're listening to this, the City Council may very well be hearing presentations and debating and discussing what would normally be the biggest story of this month, I think, at least if not this year, in the city of San Diego, and that is this historic transfer of land, the sale of Mission Valley's stadium land from the city of San Diego to San Diego State University. It is happening. I think there's a pretty good chance it becomes a unanimous vote, which is just an amazing coda to a few years watching how this thing has developed. This comes, though, after a lot of last-minute discussions. There was an 11-hour negotiating session on Wednesday between the city attorney, and SDSU and its attorneys as they tried to pull this together. But bottom line is this deal looks like it's happening. And within a few months, hundreds of millions of dollars are going to be spent to literally move a lot of earth in Mission Valley. I don't know where to start. Should we go through like the actual legal questions and stuff? Sarah?
Can I just play the Mara Elliott of this podcast and include
sure.
a disclaimer?
Yeah.
That for history's sake, there's certainly a chance that deals in San Diego could fall through.
Yeah.
And maybe all of this will be moot several minutes after we release the podcast.
Yeah.
They should could really imagine anything sillier than just assuming that this will all go swimmingly over the next
right.
48 hours.
But here we are. Let's do it.
Yeah, they should really consider the podcast before they have Friday decisions.
I feel like maybe they did, and they did it specifically to screw us, which, well done.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's fine. I can game recognize game on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's just go over the basics. So obviously the city voters decided that the city of San Diego should sell this land to San Diego State. And then they agreed on basic terms, you know, how much it should cost several months ago. But what we're talking about now is the actual purchase and sale agreement that they're gonna finalize and then go through escrow, just like you do with a house, and then actually transfer the money and transfer the property. So last week, though, late Friday, we love late Friday memos too. San Diego City Attorney Mara Elliott sent out a memo saying that if this goes through the way that it's outlined, the city could face dire consequences. You know, things are dire when an attorney puts dire in the first executive summary of their memo. Dire consequences. And at the heart of that is this question about recycled sewage. So what does that have to do? Well, let me tell you. So San Diego obviously wants to get about 30% of its water eventually from recycling our sewage. Recycled wastewater is called a pure water program. And the pure water program envisions that at least some of the infrastructure that they need for this, if not actually storage of some of the clean water, may need to occur in this Mission Valley land. And so the city attorney was warning that the plan that SDSU has said that would be okay to allow things there is inadequate and would potentially hurt the city's ability to even finish that pure water program. Now, one thing, that's a big issue because the city only treats its sewage to a primary level outside of Point Loma, the Point Loma Sewage Treatment Plant. And we have gotten waiver after waiver from the Environmental Protection Agency to continue doing that. And our deal to continue doing that is dependent on this pure water recycling plan eventually happening. So what the city attorney is saying is that our entire sewage infrastructure is in danger if this happens the way that it happens here. They met this week. They had a big negotiation about it, and they seem to have come with a breakthrough. Anything you can tell us, Andy, about what happened there or what's going on now?
Yeah. So my understanding is that it basically came down to the city wanted essentially an easement that allowed them access to this infrastructure associated with this project. I don't know that they got exactly that, but it seems like they've been able to work something out that essentially approximates that insofar as their needs are concerned. So they're able to get to the infrastructure and work on it, or at least they think so, based on this arrangement. It isn't exactly the way that they had been pushing to do it, but it seems to have satisfied everyone.
And so if that is settled, Jack McGrory, the former city manager who led the ballot initiative, Measure G, and then became a member of the Board of Trustees of the California State University, and then thus a lead negotiator on this actual deal, he broke that news late Wednesday that there was a breakthrough. They have come to an agreement, but that was after some pretty harsh words. Barbara Bree, who's running for mayor, called those demands from the city attorney outrageous. Said, had the city's ridiculous easement demands been in place when the property was originally appraised, the fair market value would have been reduced by tens of millions of dollars, implying there that we are, if this is true, what you just said, that they've made a deal on it, then we've swindled SDSU out of tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, exactly.
Mara Elliott responded. She said the city has gotten shortchanged in the past by real estate deals because it didn't pay attention to the details. And while some may be desperate for any deal at any price, my focus on getting this deal is doing it right. Ultimately, the city council must decide whether it's fair and equitable, all that stuff. So somebody texted me the other day that Mara Elliott just exaggerates a lot and makes a things bigger deal. But it seems like everybody kind of does. Like, was this just a lot of bluster?
Isn't that it does seem, politics?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, look, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. Plenty of room for this thing to go sideways in the closing stretch here. But presuming that they have ironed out all of these issues, that City Attorney Elliott is satisfied with how they've been resolved, that SDSU is happy with how they've been resolved, that the mayor's office is happy to get this project done, and that the city council is ready to approve it, all of which, my understanding, is what is going to happen tomorrow. Seems like anybody who was really harsh on her kind of maybe owes her an apology. It does seem that this is what you want a city attorney to do. And at a certain point, if you can't get over their issues, then yeah, you do have to go to the city council, and it's their it's a policy call that they're willing to make, that they have to make. They're either willing to deal with some liabilities or they're not. But you want her to make a big stink about the issues that she thinks are out there, right?
It definitely feels like things are happening perhaps how they're supposed to happen. Maybe with, more antagonizing than some people would like, but like airing issues is what this process is.
Right. Yeah. And deadlines spur action. Like this is how negotiating in public happens, right? And so I don't know. And then if you look at just like everybody's incentives here, certainly Mayor Faulkner would like this to be something of a legacy project for him. We'll just skip over the fact that he didn't endorse it until after it was already approved at the ballot box. But he'd like to get this done before he leaves office. City Council wants that money into the city before they have to adopt their next budget. Barbara Bree certainly seems interested in running on this for mayor. The only person whose interests in this case are like really long term are Mara Elliott's. Mara Elliott needs to be able to say clearly 5 years from now that if any big major issues came about, she at least identified them.
Right.
And so it does seem like everybody is basically behaving as you would expect based on their incentives, but hers are the only incentives that are outside of let's get this done pretty quickly here.
I think it might be a moment though.
Which is not to say that she wants to kill it, but
yeah. I think this might be a moment though to also step back and realize that something amazing is happening, that the outline of this basic deal of taking that entire land in Mission Valley, turning it into condos or apartments, other facilities, retail and a hotel and a new stadium, multi-use stadium, that contour of that kind of deal has been presented to the city in various ways since 2003. And now, 17 years later, it's going to happen. It might not, but it seems pretty clear that if this is really approved, and over the next few months the escrow does close, that they'll begin moving the earth and grading and preparing this land for a complete change. And so. As hard as and long as all those discussions were with the Chargers and other places, like, it doesn't seem that weird that, after 3 years after this idea was conceived, it's now implemented. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like transferring the city's most valuable piece of land with a bunch of other things that are underneath it and all these legal considerations and various ownership structures, like, it seems like a reasonable period to try to make a big switch like that, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Also, as you were talking, I was thinking that maybe, the people who said that Mara Elliott was exaggerating maybe they could view the resolution as vindication. Like, see, these things weren't actually that big a deal.
Right.
She might have been right to identify them, but it was a little overheated and we were totally capable of dealing with them or something like that.
Right, right.
But well, yeah, I think your bigger point is totally right. That, like, it's been practically two decades to get to this point. And it's probably not that big of a surprise that there were a few last deal points to iron out that took right up until the deadline.
Yeah. Well, a deadline focuses people's minds, and now the city will get a big check, a big wire transfer, I guess is how those things work, in July, and they'll spend it really quickly. So all the talk about holding on to assets and not spending them for one-time needs, I think, is not that significant in a pandemic like this. So we will watch that. We will obviously hold SDSU accountable for its promises, the River Park, and also making sure that it isolates students and families from tuition hikes or tax increases and stuff like that. We'll be watching as this development proceeds. Well, speaking of the pandemic, obviously, one of the groups that was most affected and has had the most trouble since then are the poorest of our region, the poorest residents and homeless in particular. There was a great story by Lisa Halverstadt documenting how many of the places that families who are homeless were staying in have closed, and now there's very few spots for them to go. The convention center is not welcoming them, who are actually family units. We talked about a story in North County, Encinitas. Several months ago, we talked about the story about the parking lot that the Leashtag Foundation and the city of Encinitas and Jewish Family Services were setting aside to allow people to safely park while they experienced homelessness. If they have a car, a lot of people, the last thing they get rid of is their car, even after their home. And so they have a car, but they have nowhere to actually park it. They set aside this lot in Encinitas, and it was very contentious. Remember, Kristen Gaspar, county supervisor, railed against it, held on a quasi-rally against it in some ways, and it was approved. And last week was approved again for an extension, but there was an interesting talk about the threats, or people were worried about the crime that would come from this, the societal debasement that would come from this parking lot. But a law enforcement officer put some of that in perspective. Here is what he said.
We haven't had any issues. There's been no calls as far as concerning the actual program or individuals at the program. Where we've had the problems is actually people who are not associated with the program. There are individuals, for whatever reason, that have called and called in crimes that we've unfounded. There are individuals that have trespassed on the property. There are individuals who, for some reason, I feel is trying to antagonize the group there. And so that's where we've had the issues. It's not with the people who are using the service.
Sarah, overall, that struck you as an interesting comment from law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting on its face just because we hear so much of these sort of community debates about crime, whether it's a homeless parking lot or a homeless shelter or even a housing development. These concerns are often aired and they sound very similar each time. And so to have a member of law enforcement say pretty unequivocally there have not been crimes associated with this lot, and then go a step further and say there have been problems with the very people who are bringing these issues up publicly. And then, you know, I think that if you've been following some of these national issues, it's even more interesting for context. You know, I wrote a little bit earlier this week about the woman in Central Park who called the police on somebody who suggested she should leash her dog, and said she was being threatened. And it made me think of this law passed by Shirley Weber of San Diego about racial profiling and requiring law enforcement agencies to detail who they're stopping. And in their most recent report, which just came out in January, they actually talked about these incidents of people sort of running to the police improperly and reporting threats that don't really exist, kind of just in the exact way that this sheriff's deputy described, that they're calling in unfounded crimes. And so that report suggested that California law enforcement agencies should get more training on sort of being aware that these calls can come in and not necessarily responding to crimes just by going off, you know, the exact word of how somebody details a threat.
I thought the sheriff's comments stood out to me just because it is so consistently the case that when a project like this is proposed, the same sets of concerns come out. In fact, in my very neighborhood in Golden Hill, back during the hepatitis A pandemic, when they created the safe camping area on the city's maintenance yard on B Street, a lot of my neighbors were very concerned about that and started, you know, next door campaigns and I think, you know, some angry town halls. They were organizing letter writings to Chris Ward. And then when it opened, it was just like this. It doesn't even go far enough to say that it didn't create a spike in crime. It was as if it wasn't there. It was a complete non-entity. It was a complete non-factor. And it is frustrating to me that, you know, then you wait 18 months or a year and the next place has the next proposal and the same conversation happens. And it is a Groundhog Day scenario, and it's good to have the absolute unequivocal support of somebody like the sheriff saying, look, I'm here to tell you, this didn't happen. There was no increase in crime, none. It's almost like a man bites dog part to have it say, the one problem we've had to deal with is the people who opposed this thing have been antagonizing the homeless residents who stay here and calling in false crimes. But that's almost like a side issue to me. The bigger issue is just to hear somebody say simply and clearly, there was absolutely no increase in crime from this.
Well, if you have been to our annual policy summit on local politics and such called PolitiFest, the last 2 years, the national anthem to kick it off has been sung by Voices of Our City Choir, a choir of mostly homeless individuals put together by Steph Johnson and John Brady. And it's just a great group, and we've loved partnering with them over the years for various events. And a few months ago, I moderated a debate that they held for mayor. And this week on America's Got Talent, they were featured in the audition phase, and it was just a wonderful segment for them. But I think the real special part about it for me is it's something I can be unequivocally proud of, that group. They, John and Steph, they keep it real. They go very deep on policy. They go very deep on service. This isn't just a feel-good like stunt that they've been pulling off. They are in this to help people and to change the dynamic around homelessness. And then to see them get that much of a platform and that much joy was just a real warm thing this week. And so we wanted to make sure we recognize that this week.
Whoa. Hi, everyone.
Welcome.
Hello.
Okay, and tell me the name of the choir, please.
This is the Voices of Our City Choir.
Yeah.
It's a choir I started about 4 years ago for people experiencing homelessness in San Diego.
Oh. Wow.
Yes.
What an amazing idea.
There were so many people living unsheltered in my neighborhood. I met musicians and singers, and I was like, wow, we could put together a group and sing together.
Yeah.
And there's people who are in the choir. They can't afford medicine. They can't afford rent. So we helped them out.
Right.
And through the money that we've raised, we've helped people get off the street.
Wow.
Wow.
What's the song you're going to do?
The choir actually wrote the song.
Oh, wow.
We have a songwriting workshop.
Okay, good. Let's see what happens in the next 2 or 3 minutes.
Awesome.
Listen to the sound. Of the sidewalk. Listen to the sounds of the sidewalk. Listen to the sounds of the sidewalk. Rolling on pavement with no one to be. Smooth and steady, rolling easy down the street. Searching, restless arms reaching.
Wow.
Our battle's going down with chaos all around. And the mother reassures herself everything will be all right as she steps in rhythm to the sounds of the sidewalk.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast. It's the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in our kitchens and in our bedrooms and in these areas. Maybe it just we should just say in San Diego, like, let them come at us, right? Let them come at us if they got a more popular public affairs podcast. Keep up with all of our coverage with the Morning Report newsletter. You can get that at vusd.org/morning. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief. Andrew Keats is Assistant Editor. Sarah Libby's Managing Editor. And this show is produced by Nate John. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week.